Welcome, everyone. My name is Daisha Herbulock of the Science Media Center, and thank you for joining us this morning for our briefing on alternatives to 1080, what and when. We have three speakers for you this morning who will be talking about different approaches to research into replacing the controversial pesticide 1080 or sodium monofluoroacetate, which is widely used in New Zealand currently to protect native ecosystems and also on agricultural land. Our first speaker this morning is going to be Dr. Charles Eason, who is a professor of wildlife management at Lincoln University and also the director of research at Conovation Limited, which is a company based in Auckland. Charles Eason has an extensive history researching the pros and cons of 1080 and alternative poisons, and he did his research in toxicology, his education in toxicology, and has spent 17 years in pest control at Landcare Research. Since 2006, he has been in his new role with Conovation as director of research there. His current activities are linked to environmental protection and research, product development, pest control, and biodiversity, with a focus on humane low-residue poisons. He will be speaking at a conference that is taking place tomorrow in Blenheim, which is called the NETS Biosecurity Conference, and he will be giving us today a preview of the talk that he is giving at that conference tomorrow. Our second speaker is Dr. Sean Ogilvy, who's a senior lecturer in wildlife management at Lincoln University. Sean has a PhD in ecology, and he has studied animal pest management for most of his career. He is currently investigating the fate of 1080 in the environment and has published extensively in this area. He was appointed as a member of the Environmental Risk Management Authority, or IRMA, in 2008, and previously has held science roles at both NIWA and Landcare Research. Sean will be focusing on natural toxins in his discussion today. And our third speaker, Dr. Janine Duckworth, is program leader for possum biocontrol development at Landcare Research. She is a reproductive biologist and immunologist with a PhD in animal science, and she is currently researching alternative methods of pest control, which is largely focusing on possum fertility control. That will be the topic of her discussion today. So I will hand over to our first speaker, but first a tiny bit of housekeeping. I would ask that you please hold any questions to the end. Each speaker will present with their slides, and then we will open things up for Q&A. During the presentations, I will be muting everyone except for the speaker to keep noise down on the line. And if you do have a question that you'd like to raise your hand for, as it were, you can use the chat box that you'll find in the top left-hand corner of your screen. Just go ahead and type there that your name and that you have a question, and I will call on you in the session at the end. So thank you very much, and I'll now hand on to our first speaker, Dr. Charles Eason.
Thank you, Darcia. I'm going to give a 5 or 10 minute shortened version of the presentation that I'm giving tomorrow at Blenheim, as Darcia said. And Darcia, I'll ask you to take us through the slides. So is the first slide up at the moment?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so just while that first slide is up, I just want to make a couple of points in terms of context. I'll be talking about the toxin component and the focus will change during the presentation onto biocontrol. But in terms of history and trends and thinking internationally as well as nationally, prior to 1950, we just had very old poisons internationally, things like strychnine and arsenic. And then during the 1950s to 1980s, there was a period of proliferation in terms of innovation and development, in terms of compounds like 1080, which was developed in the U.S. in the 1950s, warfarin in 1948, and then second-generation anticoagulants like bradykinin in the 1970s. But really, since the 1980s, right up to the present time, internationally, exploration on new rodenticides has been negligible, and internationally, there's a reliance on anticoagulants. So one of the reasons for that is that the market size for vertebrate pesticides and rodenticides is really small. It's a very small market. It's 0.1% of the agrochemicals that are used internationally, and the same applies nationally. So it's a small market that doesn't attract investment from multinationals like Bayer or Ciba Geigy or agrochemical companies. So in order to deal with New Zealand or Australasian problems, we really need to help ourselves in terms of local research rather than being reliant on international research where there isn't such a focus on culling unwanted introduced mammals. So that was just the starting point. And just to move on then to my next slide, please, Darcia. I guess this slide just says, why do we need new tools? And from people who are enthusiastic, or not so much enthusiastic, but support the use of 1080 as a tool that has to be used, it's very effective. And there are other compounds like bradykinin that have played a huge role in clearing over 100 islands around New Zealand of pests and making them basically sanctuaries for conservation. But having said that, some of the tools we use are persistent compounds which cause secondary poisoning and non-target deaths, and there are concerns about residues in game and livestock, and some poisons are inhumane or unpopular. And community expectations are that we can do better, and also having tools that are more usable by the community. And there's probably been 60 years of research on 1080 internationally. It still remains very controversial, refining and optimizing its use in New Zealand. And then the aspirations of biocontrol that Janine will cover later. And there's a gap between the conventional poisons and coming up with some smarter poisons and some smarter delivery systems to sort of fill the gap between conventional poisons and biocontrol. So what we've effectively done at Lincoln University, and there's a consortia of Lincoln University, Auckland University, Conservation Otago, linked through to the invasive animal CRC in Australia, is develop what we're calling a four-pronged approach, and that's the next slide here. Darcy, are we on the slide advancing low residue?
Yes, in one moment we will be. There you go.
So there's the focus, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So in terms of alternatives to 1080, the way I've packaged it here is extending the registration of acceptable low residue tools, bringing in vertebrate toxins that are widely used overseas but haven't been previously used, and then developing through Australasian and New Zealand initiatives completely new toxins which have more favorable profiles, bearing in mind that no vertebrate pesticides or rodenticides have been developed since the 1980s, with the last one off the block being bradykinin. And then the fourth strand is looking at smarter ways of delivering these toxins, so long-life baits and resettable delivery systems. So what I'll do in the shortened version of the talk I'm giving tomorrow is just to give some examples. So moving on to the next slide, which has as the title, first, extending the registration of acceptable tools. Cyanide is a tool that's been used in New Zealand 40 or 50 years in a paste bait initially, and then since 1997 in a little pellet called Ferrotox. This poison is accepted by the broader community. It's used by hunters and trappers for fur recovery, and one can be at a 1080 meeting where people might be banging the table and saying, we don't want 1080, we want to use Ferrotox or cyanide and cholecalciferol and trap. So it's a tool that has broader acceptance, and some of the reasons why are listed there. It kills on the spot for fur recovery. The carcass, it doesn't present a risk to dogs in the same way that 1080 does, so dogs can eat poison carcasses without risk, and it's proven to be very humane. Animals cracking these pellets will be conscious in a few minutes and die in 20 minutes, and that's a very favorable welfare profile compared with, say, 1080 or bradykinin. So in terms of just extending the utility, and as we extend the utility of all current alternatives to 1080, we take the pressure off 1080. So simply what we've done is recognize that 1080 is used for wallaby control in New Zealand, targeting Dharma wallabies in the North Island and Bennett's wallabies in Canterbury or South Canterbury, and the use of 1080 there is unpopular. So Ferrotox we've now developed for selling wallabies, taking the pressure off 1080, and we did the trials in the North Island in 2009 and got the registration for Dharma wallabies, and we've just completed the trials in April, May with Bennett's, and we file then with the New Zealand Food Safety Authority in IRMA for the approval to use Ferrotox for Bennett's as well as wallabies. So by the end of this year, we should have Ferrotox registered for three species, which is a rational and ethical thing to do. If we say this is humane and it's a good alternative, then extending its use to other species. Then, now another example that I haven't got a slide on is cholecalciferol, which is vitamin D3, which is currently registered as Ferricol. It's a 0.8% concentration. It's kind of an irony that a vitamin is used as a poison for culling possums, but that's kind of one of the bases of toxicology. It's a dose that distinguishes between a drug and a poison. We produced in the last year a dose, a half, we're calling it a low-dose coli. It makes it more cost-effective. The current product is a little bit too pricey. The vitamin D is too expensive. And so we produced a 0.4%, which we hope will be on the market later in the year. So that's sort of two examples, if you like, of extending the registration of current alternatives. So the next strand, and Darcia, that's the next slide, the fifth slide.
Mm-hmm.
So second registration of agents not previously used in New Zealand. And an example of this is zinc phosphide. It's kind of ironic, and I'll just jump onto the next slide, Darcia, and then back again, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
The next slide is just illustrating the international status. So with 1080, we're very much out on a limb in some regards, in that we're the major user. But there are a lot of countries that use zinc phosphide for rodent field control of rodents because it lacks secondary poisoning, and there are obviously sort of trade issues there. So just jumping back again. So the reason we're looking at this compound is a backup to 1080. It's another toxin that has some advantages. It's not a huge step forward, but it's a step forward in that doesn't cause secondary poisoning. So carcasses will not present a risk to dogs. It doesn't bioaccumulate. Over the last 10 years, probably about $1 million has been spent on research and safety and efficacy. It's a sensible backup. In terms of the registration process, you go through two agencies. It's a bit like registering a new drug. There's a huge amount of data required, and in 2009 we got the New Zealand Food Safety Authority approval. It's actually reached the very last stage, as it says at the bottom of that slide. In May 2010, we reached the IRMA evaluation and risk analysis report stage, which is about stage 18 in an approximately 20-stage approval process. So that's strand one and two. So I won't go over the international status. So, Darcy, I've jumped now to the slide that says third, new toxins and baits, RBC toxin.
Mm-hmm.
So the point here to make then is that this is talking about completely new toxins. So in some ways this is more interesting or more exciting. The previous two strands, if you like, were making the most of existing conventional alternatives to 1080. And here we're talking about designer toxins. And as I've said on the slide, they're the first new active ingredients in the rodenticide field for 30 years. It's a New Zealand-Australian initiative, and it bridges the gap between conventional poisons and the aspirations for biocontrol that we'll hear from Janine in a moment. And the first candidate in this class, and we see it as a class of compounds, not just a one-off, is Paramina propionone, or PAP, which is a toxin that targets stoats for kiwi protection and feral cats, and it will target ferrets. And I've listed along the bottom there, you'll see in the coloured blue boxes, the attributes of this. So if there was such a thing as an ideal toxin, it has all the ticks, all the boxes. The effect of this is a little bit like carbon monoxide poisoning. That's why we call it a red blood cell toxin. It causes something called methemoglobinemia, which just means the red blood cell can't carry oxygen. Animals become sleepy within an hour or two and just quietly die, which is a much nicer profile than an anticoagulant poison, where the animals basically die through loss of blood, or even 1080. It's got low risk of secondary poisoning, low toxicity to birds. And where we are with this one, we've been developing this more intensively since about 2007. Moving on to the next slide with the field trial, just to give a flavor. We do pen and then field trials with all these things. You get captive animals in, and you test them first. You do a whole load of non-target testing, and then you do your field trials, and you accumulate a wealth of toxicology data. So almost the field trials on efficacy are sometimes almost the smallest part. But this slide with the picture of the stoat and the little map down at Waitutu is just intended to illustrate that two field trials were done with stoats in 2008, 2009. They were done with feral cats in the North Island in 2009, 2010 to provide the efficacy data for registration. So moving on to the next slide, which is entitled PAP. That's just to show where we are in terms of delivery of tools. So again, it's got a bit of a registration focus. You can see that we moved through the registration process in 08, 09. And full assessment is with IRMA is progressing. We went through, as you do with all applications, the publicly notifiable stage at IRMA at the end of 2009, and submissions and public hearings finished in February 2010. Now, when 1080 was reassessed, there were something like 1,400 submissions, and some of them were obviously against 1080. And here we had 20 submissions, and they were all pro-PAP, a lot from community groups and others who are trying to control stoats and protect kiwis. So, again, as with zinc phosphide, we're very much at the latter stage of this PAP development, at least in the first delivery system. So, moving on to the next one, and this might catch people's eyes, sodium nitrite. Sodium nitrite is a meat preservative. It has the same mode of action in terms of its toxicity at high doses as does PAP, and it's one of a number of molecules that we're looking at that relate to PAP in either mode of action or structure. So that's where Auckland University come in terms of synthesizing PAP analogs. But this is just a compound that we know is toxic at high doses, and it's been developed in Australia for feral pig control, and here more for possum control, although there might be applications for pig in some circumstances. So the next slide just shows possum cage trials. You start with cage trials and then go into the field trials. So we know that we've had to encapsulate sodium nitrite. It's got a very bitter taste. So we micro-encapsulate the powder, and then it's palatable. So this is just showing that it does kill possums, and we know that Australian work that it's effective at killing pigs. So sodium nitrite is something we'll be field trialing over the next few months more for possum control. So this slide just is intended then to summarize progress on some of the new actives. The one which says progress through registration. So we've got ferrotox being extended for wallabies, with ticks all the way down. Zinc phosphide is a new active ingredient. I'll jump to PAP and sodium nitrite at the end. You can see that that's just intended to illustrate a process through the registration. So coming to the fourth avenue, if you like, and again, one of the more exciting ones is resettable systems, whether it's traps or toxins. If you think of what the end game here is, to get TB out of possum populations or to really conserve native species, then that really requires populations to be suppressed at very, very low levels and held down. And our conventional baiting system is almost a boom bust. We put baits out, pest populations, whether it's stoats or possums, are suppressed. This sort of device is intended to deliver something like 500 doses. The animal scampers through the tunnel. I hope you can see the tunnel. With stoats, it gets a spray of pap onto its stomach. It licks it off, and it dies a couple of weeks later. And that's the trials we have planned in August. The trials we've done to date, which I described earlier, were with conventional baits. And so this sort of system for possums, for stoats, for rats, will enable possum population, pest populations to be suppressed where we can get real gain. And that'll have applications on the mainland as well as offshore islands and preventing reinvasion. So my last slide is just to wrap up by saying what I've taken you through. In terms of alternatives to 1080, there's no magic bullet replacement, but we do have alternatives coming through. And some of those involve extending the use of things like Ferritox, low-dose cholecalciferol. We have zinc phosphide and PAP coming through in 2010. We have an alternative anticoagulant called C+C that I haven't really covered. We have sodium nitrite as a potential alternative for possum control. And we have new toxins, new red blood cell toxins that are related to PAP being investigated for both aerial and ground control. I guess what I've touched on is there's quite a lot coming through, but if you think of the investment that's gone into 1080, then obviously to see these things come through and have them work in practice in a number of different delivery systems and safer delivery systems will require focused research over the next 3 to 6 years to put them through to full application. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charlie. I'll hand on to our second speaker. If you could please hold your questions to the end, but do jot them down because we will have time for questions. Our next speaker is Dr. Sean Ogilvie.
Can everybody hear me okay? Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Ka nui te mihi ki a koutou, I te wā nei. I'm just extending on what you're talking about, a part of a strand of research that runs in parallel with the research that Charles has already presented to us. We talk about a conveyor belt or different tools for pest control, and he's given tools that are at different places on that conveyor belt. And I'm going to be talking about an area of research where we're really talking about the beginning of the conveyor belt, so something that's quite new. And so we're looking into naturally occurring toxins in New Zealand plants, and what potential are there for these toxins in terms of animal pest control. So to give you a brief outline, I'll talk a little bit about the pest issue, just adding to what Charles has already said. And then after that, I'm going to talk to you about research. This research has been done with Tūhoe people up in the central eastern North Island. And I'll talk to you about the journey that I've sort of taken and the team's taken with Tūhoe on this, and how that research started with looking at doing some work on the fate of 1080 in the environment, and in particular 1080 uptake in plants that Tūhoe were interested in terms of whether there was a risk to them for rongoā, so medicinal plants, or food plants, kai plants. And then from that work came some discussion around, well, you know, there's already a lot of knowledge around toxic plants, and could those plants be utilised for animal pest control in the future? So a bit of background, this about introduced pest animals, just one slide on this, and as I said, just extending on what Charles has already said, we've the introduced pest animals in New Zealand. I've given some examples there, possums, different rat species, mice and mustelids, and concerns that from the main concerns are the impacts that these species have on taonga plants, birds, bats and invertebrate species, and also the issue around the spread of TB. And as we know, aerial application of 1080 is one control method which has proven to be effective, using cereal or carrot baits. So this is a research team, the team that I've been doing this work on natural toxins. This is the team here. So as I said before, this work stems from out of Tūhoe country, and this photo here is actually taken in a little town just south of Lake Waikaremoana, a little town called Tūai. And these are the research team members here. So going back to 2003, the guy on the right-hand side there, James Waiwai, he was the chair of the trust for the Lake Waikaremoana Hapu Restoration Restoration Trust. And in the middle there, the guy in the blue shirt, Jim Doherty. These two guys in particular and others from the trust raised the question around if a helicopter flew over and dropped 1080 bait and those baits landed beside plants that they use for food or medicine, what are the risks of the plants actually taking up 1080 from the baits and then people consuming the 1080? So that's from that question from these people was where this kind of research, this trend of research began those years ago. And so this question, can plants take up 1080 from bait? I mean, 1080 is water soluble, it will move out of baits, and there's been previous research to show that that 1080 can move through into, 1080 can move through into, through the root systems and make its way into plants. There was a paper published in Nature in the 1950s that talked about the potential for using 1080 as a systemic insecticide. So we're talking about really, really large concentrations of 1080, but the idea was if you had, for example, some roses with aphids on them, you could put 1080 at the base of your rose plants, and the 1080 would leach through the soil into the roots of the plants, be taken up by the plant itself, and then when the aphids fed on the plant, they would die from, they would succumb from 1080 poisoning. So there was previous literature to show that it's potentially can happen. So our research was based around, you can see in the middle photo of the slide here, we're actually looking at a puha experiment here where we've got puha plants and we put a 1080 bait at the base of individual puha plants, and then we measured 1080 uptake over, in this case for this particular plant, over various time points up to 38 days. So we took plant samples at those time points and then analysed those samples for 1080 content. So a quick briefing on the results of this series of research experiments. We've done 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. You see there's 8 different plant species there that we've looked at over through time. And for all but one of them, we were able to show that really tiny amounts of 1080 did show up in the plants, and for those all of these plants, 1080 would appear, peak at around about sort of 5 or 6 days on average, and then be gone within 2 weeks. So there was this process of uptake and then elimination. But the pickle, which is a kind of a fern plant, you can see a photo of it there on the right-hand side of that slide. But the pickle, there was no evidence of that plant taking up 1080 from the baits. Now, one of the interesting things that came out of this research is for puha, looking at the from the experiment that I showed you on the previous slide, we actually found that there was 1080 in the puha plants before we'd even put any baits out. And for the plants that were the control plants, the ones that had non-toxic baits applied to them. So there was some evidence there that in actual fact puha had extremely low concentrations, but puha actually had 1080 present already. 1080 is a natural compound and is found in more than 30 species of plant around the world. Actually, there's a species in Africa where it's where the concentration in that plant is actually 5 times more than what we use in baits for possum control. So it is known to be present naturally, and it looked from the experiment, from the work with the pūhā, that in actual fact we'd found a plant species in New Zealand, albeit at extremely low concentrations. There we're talking about 1.6 parts per billion, which is just measurable, but looked like it was there. Now, this result caused a lot of discussion within the research team, and there was discussion around, well, we know that, when I say we, the guys are at Tūhoe there, there's a really deep knowledge of the bush and of the plants and the trees in the bush, and they said, well, look, we know a lot of plants here that are actually toxic, and the question arose, well, what's the potential for using those plants, or at least, or maybe the toxins in those plants, as new tools for vertebrate pest control? So what potential do naturally occurring toxins have for pest control was the second question that came out of this research, this line of research. So it's really integrating Mātauranga Māori with contemporary scientific knowledge, and that's, so you've got the concept, so Mātauranga knowledge, kaitiakitanga, the processes around looking after the environment, rongoā, so that's medicine, and the relationship between when a plant's bioactive, as Dale said earlier, it's the dose that matters. So if you've got a plant that's used as a rongoā, it could just as well be toxic if it's taken in too high a concentration. So that links the Mātauranga Māori with the ecology, with the toxicology, and with pharmacological principles as well. So we undertook a survey, a lot of discussion, a lot of hui around this idea, and we at this stage we've come up with a number of potential plants that could be useful for future research and exploration in terms of toxins as alternatives or new toxins to add to the toolbox of control tools. So one of the first ones that came up was tutu, widely known to be really toxic. There's a quote from a paper from the 1900s that talked about stock suffering from tutu poisoning was said to be tutted. And I've got a little note down the bottom there that says Grandma, who's in one of the previous photos, she talked about her knowledge around tutu, and when she was a child, it was they were taught you can actually eat the tutu fruit, but you've got to know the right time to take them. When they're just the right ripeness, you can eat the fruit. But she said that more recently, people have just shied away because that knowledge has been lost, the knowledge about what the right time to eat the tutu is. So just an example of the knowledge that's there. Kōwhai was another species that came up as a potential. There was some discussion that people were already using kōwhai seeds, a paste of kōwhai seeds mashed up for killing possums. We haven't looked into that any further yet, but that certainly came up in the discussion. Karaka, now this one was very interesting. The kernel of the karaka is toxic, and the karaka is actually used as a food source and has been for a long, long time. The kernels are prepared in a special way to remove the toxin, and it's some papers, we found some papers that showed that in actual fact the toxin that's in the kernel has metahemoglobinemia properties. So Charles talked about that earlier, that you can use that. It's part of the process of slowing down the ability of the red blood cells to take up oxygen. So it's a humane mechanism for pest control. And there's a whole series of compounds that can cause metahemoglobinemia. And it looks like there's a compound within the kernel of the karaka which can do that. So that's quite exciting for us. It kind of brings together two lines of research, brings together the Mātauranga with work that's going on in terms of metahemoglobinemia inducers. So we'll certainly be looking into that further. And we've got a PhD student, Cherie van Stravendijk, who's going to be looking into that. And in addition, addition to the looking at plants from a purely toxic point of view, an interesting area of discussion that came out was the knowledge that there is around using plants for anti-fertility purposes. So an example, I've just put one example up here, using the bark of the kawakawa was used as a contraceptive, and so this kind of raises the idea of actually having new compounds that could be used potentially in baits for actually lowering the fertility of best animal populations. And in a previous slide, I showed you a photo of the piritar. So I'll just go back to that one. This is piritar in this slide here. Now, piritar is known to have really strong abortive properties. So so taking some of this plant during pregnancy will cause an abortion. And so there was a lot of discussion and knowledge actually that came out around the utility of plants for anti-fertility purposes too. So that was a really interesting area of knowledge that's come out of this and leads on very nicely to what Janine will be talking about next. So just to finish off, to close, toxins are part of the toolbox. There's a need to have a suite of tools in the toolbox. We found from this research there's a lot of potential for advancement, enhancing humaneness, so looking at the metahemoglobinemia compounds that are in New Zealand plants or that are naturally in the environment, and also the ideas around lowering the fertility of pest animals. So just to sum up, or just to close, it's a long, long process from, like I said right at the start, these ideas are in the first part of the conveyor belt. There's a long process to go from a naturally occurring toxin to a pest control product, but we have learned a lot to warrant further investigation. So, yeah, we'll be looking to move some things along that conveyor belt. So that's all I've got to say. So kia ora koutou katoa.